Chapter 18. Archdeacon Brabazon. When Miss Marple, slightly out of breath and rather tired, got back to the Golden Boar, the receptionist came out from her pen and across to meet her. "Oh, Miss Marple, there is someone here who wants to speak to you. Archdeacon Brabazon." "Archdeacon Brabazon?" Miss Marple looked puzzled. "Yes, he's been trying to find you. He had heard you were with this tour, and he wanted to talk to you before you might have left or gone to London. I told him that some of them were going back to London by the later train this afternoon, but he is very, very anxious to speak to you before you go. I have put him in the television lounge. It is quieter there. The other is very noisy just at this moment." Slightly surprised, Miss Marple went to the room indicated. Archdeacon Brabazon turned out to be the elderly cleric whom she had noticed at the memorial service. He rose and came towards her.
"Miss Marple? Miss Jane Marple?"
"Yes, that is my name. You wanted—"
"I am Archdeacon Brabazon. I came here this morning to attend the service for a very old friend of mine, Miss Elizabeth Temple."
"Oh, yes," said Miss Marple. "Do sit down."
"Thank you, I will. I am not quite as strong as I was."
He lowered himself carefully into a chair.
"And you?"
Miss Marple sat down beside him. "Yes," she said. "You wanted to see me?"
"Well, I must explain how that comes about. I'm quite aware that I am a complete stranger to you. As a matter of fact, I made a short visit to the hospital at Carystown, talking to the matron, before going on to the church here. It was she who told me that before she died, Elizabeth had asked to see a fellow member of the tour, Miss Jane Marple, and that Miss Jane Marple had visited her and sat with her just a very, very short time before Elizabeth died."
He looked at her anxiously. "Yes," said Miss Marple, "that is so. It surprised me to be sent for."
"You are an old friend of hers?"
"No," said Miss Marple. "I only met her on this tour. That's why I was surprised. We had expressed ideas to each other, occasionally sat next to each other in the coach, and had struck up quite an acquaintanceship. But I was surprised that she should have expressed a wish to see me when she was so ill."
"Yes, yes, I can quite imagine that. She was, as I've said, a very old friend of mine. In fact, she was coming to see me, to visit me. I live in Filminster, which is where your coach tour will be stopping the day after tomorrow, and by arrangement she was coming to visit me there. She wanted to talk to me about various matters, about which she thought I could help her."
"I see," said Miss Marple. "May I ask you a question? I hope it is not too intimate a question."
"Of course, Miss Marple, ask me anything you like."
"One of the things Miss Temple said to me was that her presence on the tour was not merely because she wished to visit historic homes and gardens. She described it, by a rather unusual word to use, as a pilgrimage."
"Did she?" said Archdeacon Brabazon. "Did she indeed now? Yes, that's interesting. Interesting and perhaps significant."
"So what I am asking you is, do you think that the pilgrimage she spoke of was her visit to you?"
"I think it must have been," said the Archdeacon. "Yes, I think so."
"We had been talking," said Miss Marple, "about a young girl, a girl called Verity."
"Ah, yes, Verity Hunt."
"I did not know her surname. Miss Temple, I think, mentioned her only as Verity."
"Verity Hunt is dead," said the Archdeacon. "She died quite a number of years ago. Did you know that?"
"Yes," said Miss Marple, "I knew it. Miss Temple and I were talking about her. Miss Temple told me something that I did not know. She said she had been engaged to be married to the son of a Mr. Raphael. Mr. Raphael is, or again I must say was, a friend of mine. Mr. Raphael has paid the expenses of this tour out of his kindness. I think, though, that possibly he wanted, indeed intended, me to meet Miss Temple on this tour. I think he thought she could give me certain information."
"Certain information about Verity?"
"Yes."
"That is why she was coming to me. She wanted to know certain facts."
"She wanted to know," said Miss Marple, "why Verity broke off her engagement to marry Mr. Raphael's son."
Verity, said Archdeacon Brabazon, did not break off her engagement. I'm certain of that, as certain as one can be of anything.
Miss Temple did not know that, did she?
No. I think she was puzzled and unhappy about what had happened, and was coming to me to ask why the marriage did not take place.
And why did it not take place? Asked Miss Marple. Please do not think that I am unduly curious. It is not idle curiosity that is driving me. I, too, am on, not a pilgrimage, but what I should call a mission. I, too, want to know why Michael Raphael and Verity Hunt did not marry.
The Archdeacon studied her for a moment or two. You are involved in some way, he said. I see that.
I am involved, said Miss Marple, by the dying wishes of Michael Raphael's father. He asked me to do this for him.
I have no reason not to tell you all I know, said the Archdeacon slowly. You are asking me what Elizabeth Temple would have been asking me. You are asking me something I do not know myself. Those two young people, Miss Marple, intended to marry. They had made arrangements to marry. I was going to marry them. It was a marriage, I gather, which was being kept a secret. I knew both these young people. I knew that dear child Verity from a long way back. I prepared her for confirmation. I used to hold services in Lent for Easter, on other occasions, in Elizabeth Temple's school. A very fine school it was, too. A very fine woman she was. A wonderful teacher, with a great sense of each girl's capabilities for what she was best fitted for in studies. She urged careers on girls she thought would relish careers, and did not force girls that she felt were not really suited to them. She was a great woman and a very dear friend. Verity was one of the most beautiful children, girls rather, that I have come across. Beautiful in mind, in heart, as well as in appearance. She had the great misfortune to lose her parents before she was truly adult. They were both killed in a charter plane going on a holiday to Italy. Verity went to live, when she left school, with a Miss Clotilde Bradbury Scott, whom you know probably as living here. She had been a close friend of Verity's mother. There are three sisters, though the second one was married and living abroad, so there were only two of them living here. Clotilde, the eldest one, became extremely attached to Verity. She did everything possible to give her a happy life. She took her abroad once or twice, gave her art lessons in Italy, and loved and cared for her dearly in every way. Verity, too, came to love her, probably as much as she could have loved her own mother. She depended on Clotilde. Clotilde herself was an intellectual and well-educated woman. She did not urge a university career on Verity, but this, I gather, was really because Verity did not really yearn after one. She preferred to study art and music and such subjects. She lived here at the old manor house and had, I think, a very happy life. She always seemed to be happy. Naturally, I did not see her after she came here, since Filminster, where I was in the cathedral, is nearly 60 miles from here. I wrote to her at Christmas and other festivals, and she remembered me always with a Christmas card. But I saw nothing of her until the day came when she suddenly turned up, a very beautiful and fully grown young woman by then, with an attractive young man, whom I also happened to know slightly, Mr. Raphael's son, Michael. They came to me because they were in love with each other and wanted to get married.
And you agreed to marry them?
Yes, I did. Perhaps, Miss Marple, you may think that I should not have done so. They had come to me in secret, it was obvious. Clotilde Bradbury Scott, I should imagine, had tried to discourage the romance between them. She was well within her rights in doing so. Michael Raphael, I will tell you frankly, was not the kind of husband you would want for any daughter or relation of yours. She was too young, really, to make up her mind, and Michael had been a source of trouble ever since his very young days. He had been had up before junior courts. He had had unsuitable friends. He had been drawn into various gangster activities. He'd sabotaged buildings and telephone boxes. He had been on intimate terms with various girls, had maintenance claims which he had had to meet. Yes, he was a bad lot with the girls, as well as in other ways. Yet he was extremely attractive, and they fell for him and behaved in an extremely silly fashion. He had served two short jail sentences. Frankly, he had a criminal record. I was acquainted with his father, though I did not know him well, and I think that his father did all that he could, all that a man of his character could, to help his son. He came to his rescue. He got him jobs in which he might have succeeded. He paid up his debts, paid out damages. He did all this. I don't know.
But he could have done more, you think?
No, said the Archdeacon. I've come to an age now when I know that one must accept one's fellow human beings as being the kind of people and having the kind of, shall we say in modern terms, genetic make-up which gives them the characters they have. I don't think that Mr. Raphael had affection for his son, a great affection, at any time. To say he was reasonably fond of him would be the most you could say. He gave him no love. Whether it would have been better for Michael if he had had love from his father, I do not know. Perhaps it would have made no difference. As it was sad. The boy was not stupid. He had a certain amount of intellect and talent. He could have done well if he had wished to do well and taken the trouble. But he was, by nature, let us admit it frankly, a delinquent. He had certain qualities one appreciated. He had a sense of humour. He was in various ways generous and kindly. He would stand by a friend, help a friend out of a scrape. He treated his girlfriends badly, got them into trouble, as the local saying is, and then more or less abandoned them and took up with somebody else. So there I was, faced with those two, and, yes, I agreed to marry them. I told Verity, I told her quite frankly, the kind of boy she wanted to marry. I found that he had not tried to deceive her in any way. He'd told her that he'd always been in trouble, both with the police and in every other way. He told her that he was going, when he married her, to turn over a new leaf. Everything would be changed. I warned her that that would not happen. He would not change. People do not change. He might mean to change. Verity, I think, knew that almost as well as I did. She admitted that she knew it. She said, I know what Mike is like. I know he'll probably always be like it, but I love him. I may be able to help him, and I may not, but I'll take that risk. And I will tell you this, Miss Marple. I know none better. I have done a lot with young people. I have married a lot of young people, and I have seen them come to grief. I have seen them unexpectedly turn out well. But I know this and recognize it. I know when a couple are really in love with each other. And by that I do not mean just sexually attracted. There is too much talk about sex, too much attention is paid to it. I do not mean that anything about sex is wrong, that is nonsense, but sex cannot take the place of love. It goes with love, but it cannot succeed by itself. To love means the words of the marriage service, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. That is what you take on if you love and wish to marry. Those two loved each other. To love and to cherish until death do us part. And that, said the Archdeacon, is where my story ends. I cannot go on because I do not know what happened. I only know that I agreed to do as they asked, that I made the necessary arrangements. We settled a day, an hour, a time, a place. I think perhaps that I was to blame for agreeing to the secrecy.
They didn't want anyone to know, said Miss Marple.
No, Verity did not want anyone to know, and I should say most certainly Mike did not want anyone to know. They were afraid of being stopped. To Verity, I think, besides love, there was also a feeling of escape. Natural, I think, owing to the circumstances of her life. She had lost her real guardians, her parents. She had entered on her new life after their death at an age when a schoolgirl arrives at having a crush on someone. An attractive mistress, anything from the games mistress to the mathematics mistress, or a prefect, or an older girl. A state that does not last for very long is merely a natural part of life. Then from that you go on to the next stage, when you realise that what you want in your life is what complements yourself, a relationship between a man and a woman. You start then to look about you for a mate, the mate you want in life. And if you are wise, you take your time. You have friends, but you are looking, as the old nurses used to say to children, for Mr. Right to come along. Clotilde Brabry Scott was exceptionally good to Verity, and Verity, I think, gave her what I should call hero worship. She was a personality as a woman, handsome, accomplished, interesting. I think Verity adored her in an almost romantic way, and I think Clotilde came to love Verity as though she were her own daughter. And so Verity grew to maturity in an atmosphere of adoration, lived an interesting life with interesting subjects to stimulate her intellect. It was a happy life, but I think, little by little, she was conscious without knowing she was conscious, shall we say, of a wish to escape. Escape from being loved. To escape, she didn't know into what or where, but she did know after she met Michael. She wanted to escape to a life where male and female come together to create the next stage of living in this world. But she knew that it was impossible to make Clotilde understand how she felt. She knew that Clotilde would be bitterly opposed to her taking her love for Michael seriously. And Clotilde, I fear, was right in her belief. I know that now. He was not a husband that Verity ought to have taken or had. The road that she started out on led not to life, not to increased living and happiness. It led to shock, pain, death. You see, Miss Marple, that I have a grave feeling of guilt. My motives were good, but I didn't know what I ought to have known. I knew Verity, but I didn't know Michael. I understood Verity's wish for secrecy because I knew what a strong personality Clotilde Bradbury Scott had. She might have had a strong enough influence over Verity to persuade her to give up the marriage.
You think, then, that that was what she did do? You think Clotilde told her enough about Michael to persuade her to give up the idea of marrying him?
No, I do not believe that. I still do not. Verity would have told me if so. She would have got word to me.
What did actually happen on that day?
I haven't told you that yet. The day was fixed, the time, the hour, and the place, and I waited. Waited for a bride and bridegroom who didn't come, who sent no word, no excuse, nothing. I didn't know why. I never have known why. It still seems to me unbelievable. Unbelievable, I mean, not that they did not come. That could be explicable easily enough. But that they sent no word, some scrawled line of writing. And that is why I wondered and hoped that Elizabeth Temple, before she died, might have told you something, given you some message, perhaps, for me. If she knew or had any idea that she was dying, she might have wanted to get a message to me.
She wanted information from you, said Miss Marple. That, I am sure, was the reason she was coming to you.
Yes, yes, that is probably true. It seemed to me, you see, that Verity would have said nothing to the people who could have stopped her, Clotilde and Anthea Bradbury Scott. But because she had always been very devoted to Elizabeth Temple, and Elizabeth Temple had had great influence over her, it seems to me that she would have written and given her information of some kind.
I think she did, said Miss Marple.
Information, you think?
The information she gave to Elizabeth Temple, said Miss Marple, was this, that she was going to marry Michael Raphael. Miss Temple knew that. It was one of the things she said to me. She said, I knew a girl called Verity who was going to marry Michael Raphael. And the only person who could have told her that was Verity herself. Verity must have written to her or sent some word to her. And then when I said, why didn't she marry him, she said, she died.
Then we come to a full stop, said Archdeacon Brabazon.
He sighed.
Elizabeth and I know more than those two facts. Elizabeth, that Verity was going to marry Michael, and I, that those two were going to marry, that they had arranged it, and that they were coming on a settled day and time. And I waited for them, but there was no marriage, no bride, no bridegroom, no word.
And you have no idea what happened? Said Miss Marple.
I do not for one minute believe that Verity or Michael definitely parted, broke off.
But something must have happened between them, something that opened Verity's eyes, perhaps, to certain aspects of Michael's character and personality that she had not realized or known before.
That is not a satisfying answer, because still she would have let me know. She would not have left me waiting to join them together in holy matrimony. To put the most ridiculous side of it, she was a girl with beautiful manners, well brought up. She would have sent word. No, I'm afraid that only one thing could have happened.
Death? Said Miss Marple. She was remembering that one word that Elizabeth Temple had said, which had sounded like the deep tone of a bell.
Yes, Archdeacon Brabazon sighed. Death.
Love, said Miss Marple thoughtfully.
By that you mean...
He hesitated. It's what Miss Temple said to me. I said, what killed her? And she said, love. And that love was the most frightening word in the world. The most frightening word.
I see, said the Archdeacon. I see. Or I think I see.
What is your solution?
Split personality, he sighed. Something that is not apparent to other people unless they are technically qualified to observe it. Jekyll and Hyde are real, you know. They were not Stevenson's invention as such. Michael Raphael must have been schizophrenic. He had a dual personality. I have no medical knowledge, no psychoanalytic experience, but there must have been in him the two parts of two identities. One, a well-meaning, almost lovable boy, a boy perhaps whose principal attraction was his wish for happiness. But there was also a second personality, someone who was forced by some mental deformation, perhaps, something we as yet are not sure of, to kill not an enemy, but the person he loved. And so he killed Verity, not knowing perhaps why he had to or what it meant. There are very frightening things in this world of ours. Mental quirks, mental disease, or deformity of a brain. One of my parishioners was a very sad case in point. Two elderly women living together, pensioned. They had been friends in service together somewhere. They appeared to be a happy couple, and yet one day one of them killed the other. She sent for an old friend of hers, the vicar of her parish, and said, "I have killed Louisa. It is very sad," she said. "But I saw the devil looking out of her eyes, and I knew I was being commanded to kill her." Things like that make one sometimes despair of living. One says, why and how? And yet one day knowledge will come, doctors will find out, or learn just some small deformity of a chromosome or gene, some gland that overworks or leaves off working.
So you think that's what happened? Said Miss Marple.
It did happen. The body was not found, I know, for some time afterwards. Verity just disappeared. She went away from home and was not seen again.
But it must have happened then, that very day.
But surely at the trial...
You mean after the body was found when the police finally arrested Michael?
He had been one of the first, you know, to be asked to come and give assistance to the police. He had been seen about with the girl. She had been noticed in his car. They were sure all along that he was the man they wanted. He was their first suspect, and they never stopped suspecting him. The other young men who had known Verity were questioned, and one and all had alibis or lack of evidence. They continued to suspect Michael, and finally the body was found, strangled and the head and face disfigured with heavy blows. A mad, frenzied attack. He wasn't sane when he struck those blows. Mr. Hyde, let us say, had taken over.
Miss Marple shivered. The Archdeacon went on, his voice low and sad, and yet even now sometimes I hope and feel that it was some other young man who killed her,
someone who was definitely mentally deranged, though no one had any idea of it, some stranger, perhaps, whom she had met in the neighbourhood, someone who she had met by chance, who had given her a lift in a car, and then...
He shook his head. I suppose that could have been true, said Miss Marple.
Mike made a bad impression in court, said the Archdeacon. Told foolish and senseless lies. Lied as to where his car had been. Got his friends to give him impossible alibis. He was frightened. He said nothing of his plan to marry. I believe his counsel was of the opinion that that would tell against him, that she might have been forcing him to marry her, and that he didn't want to. It's so long ago now, I remember no details, but the evidence was dead against him. He was guilty, and he looked guilty. So you see, do you not, Miss Marple, that I am a very sad and unhappy man? I made the wrong judgment. I encouraged a very sweet and lovely girl to go to her death because I did not know enough of human nature. I was ignorant of the danger she was running. I believed that if she had had any fear of him, any sudden knowledge of something evil in him, she would have broken her pledge to marry him and have come to me and told me of her fear, of her knowledge of him. But nothing of that ever happened. Why did he kill her? Did he kill her, perhaps, because he knew she was going to have a child? Because by now he had formed a tie with some other girl and did not want to be forced to marry Verity. I can't believe it. Or was it some entirely different reason? Because she had suddenly felt a fear of him, a knowledge of danger from him, and had broken off her association with him? Did that rouse his anger, his fury, and did that lead him to violence and to killing her? One does not know.
You do not know, said Miss Marple, but you do still know and believe one thing, don't you?
What do you mean exactly by believe? Are you talking from the religious point of view?
Oh, no, said Miss Marple. I didn't mean that. I mean there seems to be in you, or so I feel it, a very strong belief that those two loved each other, that they meant to marry, but that something happened that prevented it. Something that ended in her death, but you still really believe that they were coming to you to get married that day?
You are quite right, my dear. Yes, I cannot help still believing in two lovers who wish to get married, who were ready to take each other on for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. She loved him, and she would have taken him for better or for worse. As far as she had gone, she took him for worse. It brought about her death.
You must go on believing as you do, said Miss Marple. I think, you know, that I believe it too.
But then what?
I don't know yet, said Miss Marple. I'm not sure, but I think Elizabeth Temple did know, or was beginning to know, what happened. A frightening word, she said. Love. I thought when she spoke that what she meant was that because of a love affair, Verity committed suicide. Because she found out something about Michael, or because something about Michael suddenly upset her and revolted her. But it couldn't have been suicide.
No, said the Archdeacon. That couldn't be so. The injuries were described very fully at the trial. You don't commit suicide by beating in your own head.
Horrible, said Miss Marple. Horrible. And you couldn't do that to anyone you loved, even if you had to kill for love, could you? If he'd killed her, he couldn't have done it that way. Strangling, perhaps, but you wouldn't beat in the face and the head that you loved. She murmured, love, love, a frightening word.
Chapter 19. Goodbyes are said. The coach was drawn up in front of the Golden Boar on the following morning. Miss Marple had come down and was saying goodbye to various friends. She found Mrs. Risley Porter in a state of high indignation.
"Really, girls nowadays," she said, "no vigour, no stamina."
Miss Marple looked at her inquiringly.
"Joanna, I mean, my niece."
"Oh, dear. Is she not well?"
"Well, she says not. I can't see anything much the matter with her. She says she's got a sore throat. She feels she might have a temperature coming on. All nonsense, I think."
"Oh, I'm very sorry," said Miss Marple. "Is there anything I can do? Look after her?"
"I should leave her alone if I were you," said Mrs. Risley Porter. "If you ask me, it's all an excuse."
Miss Marple looked inquiringly at her once more.
"Girls are so silly, always falling in love."
"Emlyn Price?" said Miss Marple.
"Oh, so you've noticed it too. Yes, they're really getting to a stage of spooning about together. I don't much care for him anyway. One of these long-haired students, you know, always going on demos or something like that. Why can't they say demonstration properly? I hate abbreviations. And how am I going to get along? Nobody to look after me, collect my luggage, take it in, take it out. Really, I'm paying for this complete trip and everything." "I thought she seemed so attentive to you," said Miss Marple. "Well, not the last day or two. Girls don't understand that people have to have a little assistance when they get to middle age. They seem to have some absurd idea, she and the Price boy, of going to visit some mountain or some landmark, about a 7 or 8 mile walk there and back."
"But surely if she has a sore throat and a temperature..."
"You'll see. As soon as the coach is gone, the sore throat will get better and the temperature will go down," said Mrs. Risley Porter. "Oh, dear, we've got to get on board now. Oh, goodbye, Miss Marple. It's nice to have met you. I'm sorry you're not coming with us."
"I'm very sorry myself," said Miss Marple. "But really, you know, I'm not so young and vigorous as you are, Mrs. Risley Porter, and I really feel after all the... well, shock and everything else the last few days, I really must have a complete 24 hours rest. We'll hope to see you somewhere in the future."
They shook hands. Mrs. Risley Porter climbed into the coach. A voice behind Miss Marple's shoulder said, "Bon voyage and good riddance." She turned to see Emlyn Price. He was grinning.
"Was that addressed to Mrs. Risley Porter?"
"Yes, who else?"
"I'm sorry to hear that Joanna is under the weather this morning."
Emlyn Price grinned at Miss Marple again.
"She'll be all right," he said, "as soon as that coach is gone."
"Oh, really?" said Miss Marple. "Do you mean..."
"Yes, I do mean," said Emlyn Price. "Joanna's had enough of that aunt of hers, bossing her around all the time."
"Then you are not going in the coach either?"
"No, I'm staying on here for a couple of days. I'm going to get around a bit and do a few excursions."
"Don't look so disapproving, Miss Marple.
You're not really as disapproving as all that, are you?"
"Well," said Miss Marple, "I have known such things happen in my own youth. The excuses may have been different, and I think we had less chance of getting away with things than you do now." Colonel and Mrs. Walker came up and shook Miss Marple warmly by the hand.
"So nice to have known you and had all those delightful horticultural talks," said the Colonel. "I believe the day after tomorrow we're going to have a real treat, if nothing else happens. Really, it's too sad, this very unfortunate accident. I must say I think myself it is an accident. I really think the coroner was going beyond everything in his feelings about this."
"It seems very odd," said Miss Marple, "that nobody has come forward. If they were up on top there, pushing about rocks and boulders and things, that they haven't come forward to say so."
"Think they'll be blamed, of course," said Colonel Walker. "They're going to keep jolly quiet, that's what they're going to do. Well, goodbye. I'll send you a cutting of that Magnolia hydarnensis, and one of the Mahonia japonica, too. Though I'm not quite sure if it would do as well where you live."
They, in turn, got into the coach. Miss Marple turned away. She turned to see Professor Wanstead waving to the departing coach. Mrs. Sanborn came out, said goodbye to Miss Marple, and got in the coach. And Miss Marple took Professor Wanstead by the arm.
"I want you," she said. "Can we go somewhere where we can talk?"
"Yes. What about the place where we sat the other day?"
"Round here there's a very nice veranda place, I think."
They walked round the corner of the hotel. There was some gay horn-blowing, and the coach departed.
"I wish, in a way, you know," said Professor Wanstead, "that you weren't staying behind. I'd rather have seen you safely on your way in the coach."
He looked at her sharply.
"Why are you staying here? Nervous exhaustion or something else?"
"Something else," said Miss Marple. "I'm not particularly exhausted, though it makes a perfectly natural excuse for somebody of my age."
"I really feel I ought to stay here and keep an eye on you."
"No," said Miss Marple, "there's no need to do that. There are other things you ought to be doing."
"What things?"
He looked at her.
"Have you got ideas or knowledge?"
"I think I have knowledge, but I'll have to verify it. There are certain things that I can't do myself. I think you will help to do them because you're in touch with what I refer to as the authorities."
"Meaning Scotland Yard, chief constables and governors of Her Majesty's prisons?"
"Yes, one or other or all of them. You might have the Home Secretary in your pocket too."
"You certainly do have ideas. Well, what do you want me to do?"
"First of all, I want to give you this address." She took out a notebook and tore out one page and handed it to him.
"What's this? Oh, yes, well-known charity, isn't it?"
"One of the better ones, I believe. They do a lot of good. You send them clothes," said Miss Marple, "children's clothes and women's clothes, coats, pullovers, all those sort of things."
"Well, do you want me to contribute to this?"
"No, it's an appeal for charity. It's a bit of what belongs to what we're doing, what you and I are doing."
"In what way?"
"I want you to make inquiries there about a parcel which was sent from here 2 days ago, posted from this post office."
"Who posted it, did you?"
No, said Miss Marple. "No, but I assumed responsibility for it."
"What does that mean?"
"It means," said Miss Marple, smiling slightly, "that I went into the post office here and I explained rather scattily and, well, like the old pussy I am, that I had very foolishly asked someone to take a parcel for me and post it, and I had put the wrong address on it. I was very upset by this. The postmistress very kindly said she remembered the parcel, but the address on it was not the one I was mentioning. It was this one. The one I have just given to you. I explained that I had been very foolish and written the wrong address on it, confusing it with another one I sometimes send things to. She told me it was too late to do anything about it now because the parcel naturally had gone off. I said it was quite all right, that I would send a letter to the particular charity to which the parcel had been sent and explain that it had been addressed to them by mistake. Would they very kindly forward it on to the charity that I had meant to receive it?"
"It seems rather a roundabout way."
"Well," said Miss Marple, "one has to say something. I'm not going to do that at all. You are going to deal with the matter. We've got to know what's inside that parcel. I have no doubt you can get means."
"Will there be anything inside the parcel to say who actually sent it?"
"I rather think not. It may have a slip of paper saying, 'From Friends,' or it may have a fictitious name and address, something like 'Mrs. Pippin, 14 Westbourne Grove,' and if anyone made inquiries there, there'd be no person of such a name living there."
"Oh, any other alternatives?"
"It might possibly, most unlikely but possible, have a slip saying, 'From Miss Anthea Bradbury Scott.'"
"Did she?"
"She took it to the post," said Miss Marple.
"And you had asked her to take it there?"
"Oh, no," said Miss Marple. "I hadn't asked anyone to post anything. The first I saw of the parcel was when Anthea passed the garden of the Golden Boar where you and I were sitting talking, carrying it."
"But you went to the post office and represented that the parcel was yours?"
"Yes," said Miss Marple, "which was quite untrue. But post offices are careful. And you see, I wanted to find out where it had been sent."
"You wanted to find out if such a parcel had been sent, and if it had been sent by one of the Bradbury Scotts, or especially Miss Anthea?"
"I knew it would be Anthea," said Miss Marple, "because we'd seen her."
"Well?"
He took the paper from her hand.
"Yes, I can set this in motion. You think this parcel will be interesting?"
"I think the contents of it might be quite important."
"You like keeping your secrets, don't you?"
said Professor Wanstead. "Not exactly secrets," said Miss Marple. "They are only probabilities that I am exploring. One does not like to make definite assertions unless one has a little more definite knowledge."
"Anything else?"
I think that whoever's in charge of these things ought to be warned that there might be a second body to be found."
"Do you mean a second body connected with the particular crime that we've been considering? A crime that took place 10 years ago?"
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "I am quite sure of it, as a matter of fact."
"Another body? Whose body?"
"Well," said Miss Marple, "it's only my idea so far."
"Any idea where this body is?"
"Oh, yes," said Miss Marple. "I'm quite sure I know where it is. But I have to have a little more time before I can tell you that."
"What kind of a body? Man's, woman's, child's, girl's?"
"There's another girl who is missing," said Miss Marple. "A girl called Nora Broad. She disappeared from here, and she's never been heard any more of. I think her body might be in a particular place." Professor Wanstead looked at her.
"You know, the more you say, the less I like leaving you here," he said. "Having all these ideas and possibly doing something foolish. Either..."
He stopped.
"Either it's all nonsense," said Miss Marple.
"No, no, I didn't mean that. But either you know too much, which might be dangerous. I think I'm going to stay here to keep an eye on you."
"No, you're not," said Miss Marple. "You've got to go to London and set certain things moving."
"You spoke as though you knew a good deal now, Miss Marple."
"I think I do know a good deal now, but I have got to be sure."
"Yes, but if you make sure, that may be the last thing you do make sure of. We don't want a third body, yours."
"Oh, I'm not expecting anything like that," said Miss Marple.
"There might be danger, you know, if any of your ideas are right. Have you suspicions of any one particular person?"
"I think I have certain knowledge as to one person. I have got to find out. I have got to stay here. You asked me once if I felt an atmosphere of evil. Well, that atmosphere is here all right. An atmosphere of evil, of danger, if you like, of great unhappiness, of fear. I've got to do something about that. The best I can do. But an old woman like me can't do very much."
Professor Wanstead counted under his breath. 1, 2, 3, 4...
"What are you counting?" asked Miss Marple.
"The people who left in the coach. Presumably you're not interested in them, since you've let them go off and you're staying here."
"Why should I be interested in them?"
"Because you said Mr. Raphael had sent you in the coach for a particular reason, and sent you on this tour for a particular reason, and sent you to the old manor house for a particular reason. Very well, then. The death of Elizabeth Temple ties up with someone in the coach. Your remaining here ties up with the old manor house."
"You're not quite right," said Miss Marple. "There are connections between the two. I want someone to tell me things."
"Do you think you can make anyone tell you things?"
"I think I might. You'll miss your train if you don't go soon."
"Take care of yourself," said Professor Wanstead.
"I mean to take care of myself." The door into the lounge opened and two people came out, Miss Cook and Miss Barrow.
"Hello," said Professor Wanstead. "I thought you'd gone off with the coach."
"Well, we changed our minds at the last moment," said Miss Cook cheerfully. "You know, we've just discovered that there are some very agreeable walks near here, and there are one or two places I'm very anxious to see. A church with a very unusual Saxon font, only 4 or 5 miles away, and quite easily reached by the local bus, I think. You see, it's not only houses and gardens. I'm very interested in church architecture."
"So am I," said Miss Barrow.
"There's also Finlay Park, which is a very fine piece of horticultural planting not far from here. We really thought that it would be much pleasanter to stay here for a day or two." "You're staying here at the Golden Boar?"
"Yes. We were fortunate enough to be able to get a very nice double room. Really a better one than the one we've had for the last 2 days." "You will miss your train," said Miss Marple again.
"I wish," said Professor Wanstead, "that you..."
"I shall be quite all right," said Miss Marple urgently. "Such a kind man," she said, as he disappeared round the side of the house, "who really takes so much care of me. I might be a great aunt of his or something like that."
"It's all been a great shock, hasn't it?" said Miss Cook.
"Perhaps you may like to come with us when we go to visit St. Martin's in the Grove." "You're very kind," said Miss Marple, "but I don't think today I feel quite strong enough for expeditions. Perhaps tomorrow, if there is anything interesting to see."
"Well, we must leave you then."
Miss Marple smiled at them both and went into the hotel. Chapter 20. Miss Marple has ideas. Having had lunch in the dining room, Miss Marple went out on the terrace to drink her coffee. She was just sipping her second cup when a tall, thin figure came striding up the steps and approached her, speaking rather breathlessly. She saw that it was Anthea Bradbury Scott.
"Oh, Miss Marple, we've only just heard, you know, that you didn't go with the coach after all. We thought you were going on with the tour. We had no idea you were staying on here." Both Clotilde and Lavinia sent me here to say we do so hope you will come back to the old manor house and stay with us. I'm sure it will be nicer for you to be there. There are so many people coming and going here always, especially over a weekend and things like that. So we'd be very, very glad, we really would, if you would come back to us.
Oh, that's very kind of you, said Miss Marple. Really very kind, but I'm sure, I mean, you know, it was just a 2-day visit. I meant originally to go off with the coach. I mean, after the 2 days. If it hadn't been for this very, very tragic accident. But, well, I really felt I couldn't go on any longer. I thought I must have at least, well, at least one night's rest. But, I mean, it would be so much better if you came to us. We'd try and make you comfortable.
Oh, there's no question of that, said Miss Marple. I was extremely comfortable staying with you. Oh, yes, I did enjoy it very much. Such a beautiful house. And all your things are so nice. You know, your china and glass and furniture. It's such a pleasure to be in a home and not a hotel.
Then you must come with me now. Yes, you really must. I could go and pack your things for you.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. I can do that myself.
Well, shall I come and help you?
That would be very kind, said Miss Marple. They repaired to her bedroom, where Anthea, in a somewhat slapdash manner, packed Miss Marple's belongings together. Miss Marple, who had her own ways of folding things, had to bite her lip to keep an air of complacency on her face. Really, she thought, she can't fold anything properly. Anthea got hold of a porter from the hotel, and he carried the suitcase round the corner and down the street to the old manor house. Miss Marple tipped him adequately and, still uttering fussy little speeches of thanks and pleasure, rejoined the sisters.
The three sisters, she was thinking. Here we are again.
She sat down in the drawing-room and closed her eyes for a minute, breathing rather fast. She appeared to be somewhat out of breath. It was only natural, she felt, at her age, and after all, Anthea and the hotel porter had set a fast pace. But really, she was trying to acquire through her closed eyes what the feeling was she had on coming into this house again. Was something in it sinister? No, not so much sinister as unhappy. Deep unhappiness. So much so it was almost frightening. She opened her eyes again and looked at the two other occupants of the room. Mrs. Glynn had just come in from the kitchen, bearing an afternoon tea tray. She looked as she had looked all along, comfortable, no particular emotions or feelings. Perhaps almost too devoid of them, Miss Marple thought. Had she accustomed herself, through perhaps a life of some stress and difficulty, to show nothing to the outer world, to keep a reserve and let no one know what her inner feelings were? She looked from her to Clotilde. She had a Clytemnestra look, as she had thought before. She had certainly not murdered her husband, for she had never had a husband to murder, and it seemed unlikely that she had murdered the girl to whom she was said to have been extremely attached. That, Miss Marple was quite sure, was true. She had seen before how the tears had welled from Clotilde's eyes when the death of Verity had been mentioned. And what about Anthea? Anthea had taken that cardboard box to the post office. Anthea had come to fetch her. Anthea. She was very doubtful about Anthea. Scatty? Too scatty for her age. Eyes that wandered and came back to you. Eyes that seemed to see things that other people might not see over your shoulder. She's frightened, thought Miss Marple. Frightened of something. What was she frightened of? Was she perhaps a mental case of some kind? Frightened, perhaps, of going back to some institution or establishment where she might have spent part of her life? Frightened of those two sisters of hers feeling that it was unwise for her to remain at liberty? Were they uncertain, those two, what their sister Anthea might do or say? There was some atmosphere here. She wondered, as she sipped the last of her tea, what Miss Cook and Miss Barrow were doing. Had they gone to visit that church, or was that all talk, meaningless talk? It was odd. odd the way they had come and looked at her at St. Mary Mead so as to know her again on the coach, but not to acknowledge that they had ever seen or met her before. There were quite a lot of difficult things going on. Presently, Mrs. Glynn removed the tea tray, Anthea went out into the garden, and Miss Marple was left alone with Clotilde.
"I think," said Miss Marple, "that you know an Archdeacon Brabazon, do you not?"
"Oh, yes," said Clotilde. "He was in church yesterday at the service. Do you know him?"
"Oh, no," said Miss Marple, "but he did come to the Golden Boar, and he came and spoke to me there. I gather he had been to the hospital and was inquiring about poor Miss Temple's death. He wondered if Miss Temple had sent any message to him. I gather she was thinking of paying him a visit. But, of course, I told him that although I did go there in case I could do anything, there was nothing that could be done except sit by poor Miss Temple's bed. She was unconscious, you know. I could have done nothing to help her."
"She didn't say anything? Any explanation of what had happened?" asked Clotilde.
She asked without much interest. Miss Marple wondered if she felt more interest than she expressed, but on the whole she thought not. She thought Clotilde was busy with thoughts of something quite different.
"Do you think it was an accident?" Miss Marple asked. "Or do you think there is something in that story that Mrs. Risley Porter's niece told about seeing someone pushing a boulder?"
"Well, I suppose if those two said so, they must have seen it."
"Yes, they both said so, didn't they?" said Miss Marple. "Though not quite in the same terms, but perhaps that's quite natural."
Clotilde looked at her curiously. "You seem to be intrigued by that."
"Well, it seems so very unlikely," said Miss Marple.
"An unlikely story, unless..."
"Unless what?"
"Well, I just wondered," said Miss Marple.
Mrs. Glynn came into the room again.
"You just wondered what?" she asked.
"We're talking about the accident, or the non-accident," said Clotilde.
"But who? It seems a very odd story that they told," said Miss Marple again.
"There's something about this place," said Clotilde suddenly. "Something about this atmosphere. We never got over it here. Never. Never since Verity died. It's years, but it doesn't go away. A shadow's here." She looked at Miss Marple. "Don't you think so too? Don't you feel a shadow here?"
"Well, I'm a stranger," said Miss Marple. "It's different for you and your sisters who've lived here and who knew the dead girl. She was, I gather, as Archdeacon Brabazon was saying, a very charming and beautiful girl."
"She was a lovely girl. A dear child, too," said Clotilde.
"I wish I'd known her better," said Mrs. Glynn. "Of course, I was living abroad at that time. My husband and I came home on leave once, but we were mostly in London. We didn't come down here often."
Anthea came in from the garden. She was carrying in her hand a great bunch of lilies.
"Funeral flowers," she said. "That's what we ought to have here today, isn't it? I'll put them in a great jar. Funeral flowers."
And she laughed suddenly, a queer, hysterical little giggle.
"Anthea," said Clotilde, don't. Do that. It's not right."
"I'll go and put them in water,"
said Anthea cheerfully. She went out of the room.
"Really," said Mrs. Glynn, "Anthea, I do think she's..."
"She's getting worse," said Clotilde.
Miss Marple adopted an attitude of not listening or hearing. She picked up a small enamel box and looked at it with admiring eyes.
"She'll probably break a vase now," said Lavinia. She went out of the room.
Miss Marple said,
"You are worried about your sister? About Anthea?"
"Well, yes. She's always been rather unbalanced. She's the youngest, and she was rather delicate as a girl. But lately I think she's got definitely worse. She hasn't got any idea, I think, of the gravity of things. She has these silly fits of hysteria. Hysterical laughter at things one ought to be serious about. We don't want to, well, to send her anywhere or... you know. She ought to have treatment, I think, but I don't think she would like to go away from home. This is her home, after all. Though sometimes it's very difficult."
"All life is difficult sometimes," said Miss Marple.
"Lavinia talks of going away," said Clotilde. "She talks of going to live abroad again. At Taormina, I think. She was there with her husband a lot, and they were very happy. She's been at home with us now for many years, but she seems to have this longing to get away and to travel. Sometimes I think she doesn't like being in the same house as Anthea."
"Oh, dear," said Miss Marple. "Yes, I have heard of cases like that where these difficulties do arise."
"She's afraid of Anthea," said Clotilde. "Definitely afraid of her. And really, I keep telling her there's nothing to be afraid of. Anthea's just rather silly at times. You know, has queer ideas and says queer things. But I don't think there's any danger of her... Well, I mean, of... Oh, I don't know what I mean. Doing anything dangerous or strange or queer."
"There's never been any trouble of that kind?" inquired Miss Marple.
"Oh, no, there's never been anything. She gets nervous fits of temper sometimes, and she takes rather sudden dislikes to people. She's very jealous, you know, over things. Very jealous of a lot of, well, fuss being made over different people. I don't know. Sometimes I think we'd better sell this house and leave it altogether."
"It is sad for you, isn't it?" said Miss Marple. "I think I can understand that it must be very sad for you living here with the memory of the past."
"You understand that, do you?" "Yes, I can see that you do. One cannot help it. One's mind goes back to that dear, lovable child. She was like a daughter to me. She was the daughter, anyway, of one of my best friends. She was very intelligent, too. She was a clever girl. She was a good artist. She was doing very well with her art training and designing. She was taking up a good deal of designing. I was very proud of her. And then this wretched attachment, this terrible, mentally afflicted boy."
"You mean Mr. Raphael's son, Michael Raphael?"
"Yes. If only he'd never come here. It just happened that he was staying in this part of the world, and his father suggested he might look us up, and he came and had a meal with us. He could be very charming, you know. But he always had been a sad delinquent, a bad record. He'd been in prison twice, and a very bad history with girls. But I never thought that Verity... Just a case of infatuation. I suppose it happens to girls at that age. She was infatuated with him. Insisted that everything that had happened to him had not been his fault. You know the things girls say. Everyone is against him. That's what they always say. Everyone's against him. Nobody made allowances for him. Oh, one gets tired of hearing these things said. Can't one put a little sense into girls?"
"They have not usually very much sense, I agree," said Miss Marple.
"She wouldn't listen. I tried to keep him away from the house. I told him he was not to come here any more. That, of course, was stupid. I realised that afterwards. It only meant that she went and met him outside the house. I don't know where. They had various meeting places. He used to call for her in his car at an agreed spot and bring her home late at night. Once or twice he didn't bring her home until the next day. I tried to tell them it must stop, that it must all cease, but they wouldn't listen. Verity wouldn't listen. I didn't expect him to, of course."
"She intended to marry him?" asked Miss Marple.
"Well, I don't think it ever got as far as that. I don't think he ever wanted to marry her or thought of such a thing."
"I am very sorry for you," said Miss Marple. "You must have suffered a lot."
"Yes. The worst was having to go and identify the body. That was some time after she disappeared from here. We thought, of course, that she'd run away with him, and we thought that we'd get news of them sometime. I knew the police seemed to be taking it rather seriously. They asked Michael to go to the police station and help them with inquiries, and his account of himself didn't seem to agree with what local people were saying. Then they found her. A long way from here, about 30 miles away, in a kind of ditchy, hedgy spot down an unfrequented lane where anyone hardly ever went. Yes, I had to go and view the body in the mortuary. A terrible sight. The cruelty, the force that had been used. What did he want to do that to her for? Wasn't it enough that he strangled her? He strangled her with her own scarf. I can't talk about it any more. I can't bear it. I can't bear it."
Tears rained suddenly down her face.
"I'm sorry for you," said Miss Marple. "I'm very, very sorry."
"I believe you are."
Clotilde looked at her suddenly. "And even you don't know the worst of it."
"In what way?"
"I don't know. I don't know about Anthea."
"What do you mean about Anthea?"
"She was so queer at that time. She was very jealous. She suddenly seemed to turn against Verity, to look at her as though she hated her. Sometimes I thought perhaps... Oh, no, it's an awful thing to think. You can't think that about your own sister. She did once attack someone. You know, she used to get these storms of rage. I wondered if it could have been... Oh, I mustn't say such things. There's no question of any such thing. Please forget what I've said. There's nothing in it, nothing at all. But, well, she's not quite normal. I put a face that. When she was quite young, queer things happened once or twice with animals. We had a parrot that said things. Silly things like parrots do say, and she wrung its neck. And I've never felt the same since. I've never felt that I could trust her. I've never felt sure. I've never felt... Oh, goodness, I'm getting hysterical too.
Come, come, said Miss Marple. Don't think of these things.
No, it's bad enough to know that Verity died in that horrible way. At any rate, other girls are safe from that boy. Life sentence he got. He's still in prison. They won't let him out to do anything to anyone else. Though why they couldn't bring it in as some mental trouble, diminished responsibility, one of these things they use nowadays. He ought to have gone to Broadmoor. I'm sure he wasn't responsible for anything that he did.
She got up and went out of the room. Mrs. Glynn had come back and passed her sister in the doorway. "You mustn't pay any attention to Clotilde," she said. "She's never quite recovered from that ghastly business years ago. She loved Verity very much. She seems to be worried about your other sister." "About Anthea? Well, Anthea's all right. She's scatty, you know. She's a bit hysterical. Apt to get worked up about things, and she has queer fancies, imagination sometimes. But I don't think there's any need for Clotilde to worry so much." "Dear me, who's that passing the window?" Two apologetic figures suddenly showed themselves in the French window.
"Oh, do excuse us," said Miss Barrow. "We were just walking round the house to see if we could find Miss Marple. We had heard she'd come here with you, and I wonder... Oh, there you are, my dear Miss Marple. I wanted to tell you that we didn't get to that church after all this afternoon. Apparently it's closed for cleaning, so I think we shall have to give up any other expedition today and go on one tomorrow. I do hope you don't mind us coming in this way. I did ring at the front doorbell, but it didn't seem to be ringing."
"I'm afraid it doesn't sometimes," said Mrs. Glynn. "You know, it's rather temperamental. Sometimes it rings and sometimes it doesn't. But do sit down and talk to us a little. I'd no idea that you hadn't gone with the coach."
"No, we thought we would do a little sightseeing round here, as we had got so far. And going with the coach would really be rather, well, rather painful after what has happened just a day or two ago."
"You must have some sherry," said Mrs. Glynn. She went out of the room and presently returned. Anthea was with her, quite calm now, bringing glasses and a decanter of sherry, and they sat down together.
"I can't help wanting to know," said Mrs. Glynn, "what really is going to happen in this business, I mean, of poor Miss Temple. I mean, it seems so very impossible to know what the police think. They still seem to be in charge, and I mean the inquest being adjourned, so obviously they are not satisfied. I don't know if there's anything in the nature of the wound."
"I shouldn't think so," said Miss Barrow.
"I mean a blow on the head, bad concussion. Well, I mean that came from the boulder. The only point is, Miss Marple, if the boulder rolled itself down, or somebody rolled it."
"Oh," said Miss Cook, "but surely you can't think that. Who on earth would want to roll a boulder down, do that sort of thing? I suppose there are always hooligans about, you know, some young foreigners or students. I really wonder, you know, whether, well..."
"You mean," said Miss Marple,
You wondered if that someone was one of our fellow travellers.
Well, I didn't say that, said Miss Cook.
But surely, said Miss Marple, we can't help, well, thinking about that sort of thing. I mean, there must be some explanation. If the police seem sure it wasn't an accident, well, then it must have been done by somebody. And, well, I mean, Miss Temple was a stranger to this place here. It doesn't seem as if anyone could have done it, anyone local, I mean. So it really comes back to, well, I mean, to all of us who were in the coach, doesn't it? She gave a faint, rather whinnying old lady's laugh.
Oh, surely.
No, I suppose I ought not to say such things. But you know, really, crimes are very interesting. Sometimes the most extraordinary things have happened.
Have you any definite feeling yourself, Miss Marple? I should be interested to hear, said Clotilde.
Well, one does think of possibilities.
Mr. Caspar, said Miss Cook. You know, I didn't like the look of that man from the first. He looked to me, well, I thought he might have something to do with espionage or something. You know, perhaps come to this country to look for atomic secrets or something.
I don't think we've got any atomic secrets round here, said Mrs. Glynn.
Of course we haven't, said Anthea. Perhaps it was someone who was following her. Perhaps it was someone who was tracking her because she was a criminal of some kind.
Nonsense, said Clotilde. She was the headmistress, retired, of a very well-known school. She was a very fine scholar. Why should anyone be trying to track her down?
Oh, I don't know. She might have gone peculiar or something.
I'm sure, said Mrs. Glynn, that Miss Marple has some ideas.
Well, I have some ideas, said Miss Marple. It seems to me that, well, the only people that could be... Oh, dear, this is so difficult to say. But I mean there are two people who just spring into one's mind as possibilities logically. I mean, I don't think that it's really so at all, because I'm sure they're both very nice people. But I mean there's nobody else really, logically, who could be suspected, should I say.
Who do you mean? This is very interesting.
Well, I don't think I ought to say such things. It's only a sort of wild conjecture.
Who do you think might have rolled the boulder down? Who do you think could have been the person that Joanna and Emlyn Price saw?
Well, what I did think was that perhaps they hadn't seen anybody.
I don't quite understand, said Anthea. They hadn't seen anybody?
Well, perhaps they might have made it all up.
What, about seeing someone?
Well, it's possible, isn't it?
Do you mean as a sort of joke, or a sort of unkind idea? What do you mean?
Well, I suppose one does hear of young people doing very extraordinary things nowadays, said Miss Marple. You know, putting things in horses' eyes, smashing legation windows and attacking people, throwing stones at people, and it's usually being done by somebody young, isn't it? And they were the only young people, weren't they?
You mean Emlyn Price and Joanna might have rolled over that boulder?
Well, they're the only sort of obvious people, aren't they? Said Miss Marple.
Fancy, said Clotilde. Oh, I should never have thought of that. But I see, yes, I just see that there could be something in what you say. Of course, I don't know what those two were like. I haven't been travelling with them.
Oh, they were very nice, said Miss Marple. Joanna seemed to me a particularly, you know, capable girl.
Capable of doing anything? Asked Anthea.
Anthea, said Clotilde, do be quiet.
Yes, quite capable, said Miss Marple. After all, if you're going to do what may result in murder, you'd have to be rather capable, so as to manage not to be seen or anything.
They must have been in it together, though, suggested Miss Barrow.
Oh, yes, said Miss Marple. They were in it together, and they told roughly the same story. They are the, well, they are the obvious suspects, that's all I can say. They were out of sight of the others. All the other people were on the lower path. They could have gone up to the top of the hill. They could have rocked the boulder. Perhaps they didn't mean to kill Miss Temple especially. They may have meant it just as a, well, just as a piece of anarchy, or smashing something or someone.
anyone, in fact. They rolled it over, and then, of course, they told the story of seeing someone there, some rather peculiar costume or other, which also sounds very unlikely. And, well, I oughtn't to say these things, but I have been thinking about it.
It seems to me a very interesting thought, said Mrs. Glynn. What do you think, Clotilde?
I think it's a possibility. I shouldn't have thought of it myself.
Well, said Miss Cook, rising to her feet, we must be going back to the Golden Boar now. Are you coming with us, Miss Marple?
Oh, no, said Miss Marple. I suppose you don't know. I've forgotten to tell you. Miss Bradbury Scott very kindly asked me to come back and stay another night, or two nights, here.
Oh, I see. Well, I'm sure that'll be very nice for you. Much more comfortable. They seem rather a noisy lot that have arrived at the Golden Boar this evening.
Won't you come round and have some coffee with us after dinner? Suggested Clotilde. It's quite a warm evening. We can't offer you dinner because I'm afraid we haven't got enough in the house, but if you'll come in and have some coffee with us...
That would be very nice, said Miss Cook. Yes, we will certainly avail ourselves of your hospitality.